Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Smith for POL 1040 and 4020. And today we're going to be talking about the philosophy of the utilitarians of the late 18th and early and mid 19th century. In particular, we're going to be talking about a guy named Jeremy Bentham and another gentleman who he helped teach, who was the son of another of the great utilitarians. We're not going to spend as much time on him. We'll just kind of mention him, James Mill. And his son was John Stuart Mill. We're going to be talking about both of them at length, both John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham. Just to give you a sense of where I got some of my sources, not all my sources, of course, beyond the key readings of Bentham's A Fragment on Government and Mill's Principles of Political Economy and On Liberty and Utilitarianism. I also looked at, I have a wonderful essay I read, which is published as a preface to the Cambridge edition of A Fragment on Government by a gentleman named Ross Harrison, and Stephen Nathanson's introduction to his, edited version of Principles of Political Economy by John Stuart Mill, also the Cambridge edition. Some online resources I used, in particular, I relied on the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy's article on John Bentham. Guys, this is my second lecture of the day. I apologize. Jeremy Bentham by William Sweet, who's a professor, it looks like, at St. Francis Xavier University up in Canada. And the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy's article on Jeremy Bentham, first published back in 2015 with some revisions in 2019, it looks like, by James E. Crimmins. I also looked at an article on the Stanford Encyclopedia entitled Mill's Moral and Political Philosophy. It's a very good one. Especially, I love the early parts, in particular, by David Brink, published in 2018. And the History of Utilitarianism on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy by Julia Driver of the University of Texas from 2014. So I looked at a bunch of stuff, and of course that's the great works are always the way to go. Start with the first materials and then go look for other things to help you interpret them. In particular, On Liberty and Utilitarianism by Mill are very easy reads. Bentham's A Fragment on Government, pretty darn easy read. Some of the other books and works we're going to talk about are a little longer, a little tougher. Notably, Mill's Principles of Political Economy is a bit of a doozy of a work. But, you know, so it goes. So first we're going to talk about Jeremy Bentham and his works, and then we'll talk about J.S. Mill. So to give you a basic background on Bentham's life, Bentham lived from 1748 to 1832. He was born in London, lived most of his life, from what I can tell there. He went to the Westminster School in London and then Queen's College of Oxford. He was trained as a lawyer, admitted to Lincoln's Inn, and attended law courts in London and at Oxford on the art of, he read the law for that. And actually, he heard his great nemesis give lectures, a gentleman by the name of Blackstone, who wrote one of the most important commentaries on law. And in fact, the fragment was intended to be part of a broader work called A Comment on the Commentaries. So bear that in mind, that he actually heard the guy he's responded to in person. He gets admitted to the bar. He becomes a lawyer in title, but he doesn't really practice either at all or at least very little because at the same time he starts to read some continental philosophers, Beccaria and Helvetius, and a number of the different French and Swiss thinkers, Italian thinkers. And he becomes more interested in philosophy and the philosophy of law and the philosophy of justice, as well as the logic, the essential logic of organizing political institutions and how we could do that better. His first really important book, A Fragment on Government, is published in 1776. He spends some time all over the place. He spends time in Russia, a little bit of time in Russia, where he will write two later publications, two things that aren't published until much later. So in the 1780s, he's in Russia, where he writes The Defense of Usury and the Panopticon Papers. And we're going to talk a little bit about both of those. He also publishes in 1789 Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation. And a number of different works that he hopes will, like brief essays and stuff, that are intended to try and give advice to the French as they design their new constitution. Of course, 89 being the year the French Revolution began. And several of his works, including his works on the Panopticon, are going to be read, actually, in the French legislature. And he's going to be made in 1792 an honorary citizen of the French Republic. But ultimately, it's not going to work. He's not going to have much of an influence, to be frank, on the French. He's also going to make an effort to try to bring about reforms in the British system. And in fact, after the 1790s begin, the vast majority of his work is going to be aimed at trying to influence real-world utilitarian change, real-world implementation of reform that we would regard today probably as progressive, and in the British system. And by and large, some of this is going to be influential. Certainly in the long run, it's influential. His kind of baby, the idea of the Panopticon, will actually, there will be an effort to try and build it that's begun in the House of Lords in 1794, pardon me. And ultimately, it's going to collapse. And he's going to work on that for well over a decade before it finally just, Parliament says it's not going to happen, tough nuggies. And that's kind of it. And they give him his money. They reward him for his efforts, is a better way to put it. So we'll talk about some other specific dates as we go. A couple interesting things. He did start college at 12, which still blows my mind. BA in 1763. He also got a master's degree in 1766. So he was pretty impressive. He was a smart guy, very, very smart man. So what we should say first off is that many of the concepts that we're going to talk about with regards to Bentham himself did not invent. He found them in the work of those guys I mentioned already, like Helvetius and Beccaria and so forth. But Bentham is going to popularize them. He's going to, in many ways, give them the character that we know them as today or know them by today. But even like the formal term, like Helvetius and a gentleman by the name of Priestley both had used the term utility principle in their work before him. And Beccaria literally is going to introduce the concept we're going to talk about here in a moment, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. That's literally stated in this gentleman's work, which we normally associate with the work of Bentham. So it's important to bear in mind that Bentham and Mill are going to be very important as part of like a broader intellectual movement that's not just British, but it's also continental. It's going to impact the Americans quite a bit as well. So let's bear that in mind. Okay, so right off the bat, we have A Fragment on Government, 1776. And really, the most important thing in A Fragment of Government is, well, before we get into that, it should be said this is very much intended to be a criticism of Blackstone's commentaries. Now, Blackstone's commentaries are a very well-intended effort by this gentleman, William Blackstone, who is a scholar of law in Britain, who's attempting for the first time to lay out all of the and systematize all the logic and fundamentals of the British legal system, which if you're even vaguely familiar with how law functions in the English-speaking world, you know it can be complicated to say the least. It's an evolved system that's in many ways kind of is deeply cultural, deeply complex, not rational in the sense of the French Revolution and Jefferson and their vision of the French Revolution, as if that's a person. The French revolutionaries and encyclopedists and their vision of like a very simplified, elegant, kind of neoclassical, straight lines world. If you look at the English legal system, it doesn't match that vision of the world at all. It is traditional. It is conservative. It is complicated. But it also has a lot of wonderful attributes because of that very complicated nature, as we've talked about quite a bit with Burke, of course. So when we look at Blackstone is basically, he's written this work and he's delivered a lot of lectures at about the same time and before, trying to teach the logic of law. And indeed, the whole idea of teaching law is kind of intriguing, because prior to Blackstone, we can really speak about reading the law as being the primary way in which people in the English-speaking world learned law. They read and read and read, and then they, in essence, worked as with lawyers. They spent time in court, and they spent time in law firms, or they spent time with judges, and they learned the law in practice in the same way, golly, you learn to be a sushi chef. So the idea of a law school, in the sense that we think of it functioning today, to a substantial degree, is the product of the work of Blackstone in the English-speaking world. Now, what this did, of course, is it led Blackstone to all sorts of different kinds of understandings of the world, that some of which will continue to be in vogue today, but others, of course, are more problematic. One of the things, though, he does is Blackstone attempts to very briefly kind of talk about the origins of government and the fundamental logic and purpose of government as an underpinning of this precept, if you will, of the law. And he doesn't do this because that's his primary function, but he sees it as kind of necessary. He's in this tradition of guys like Locke and Rousseau and Hobbes and all these other thinkers of the Enlightenment period, and he feels like that's a necessary thing to include. And for whatever reason, this really gets the goat of Mr. Bentham. Bentham, A, thinks the law in Britain is a mess. It needs to be rationalized. It needs to be reorganized. Frankly, it needs to be made more scientific. If we're going to have laws, the law should have a reason that is practical and knowable and explicable. It shouldn't just because we've already always done it that way. That's not an excuse in the eyes of Bentham. And so Bentham wants a rationalized vision of law. He wants a reform of law. And he is in particular incensed with this classical kind of definition of where do governments come from, what are things like natural rights and all this stuff, because our man Bentham is, in his own vision certainly, an empiricist. Bentham, I've got a whole list of kind of things that sum up Bentham's view on empiricism. He held that all knowledge was ultimately derived from sensation, and that we can only really genuinely know what can be observed and verified using those senses. So this isn't completely new. This is in holding with some of the thoughts and logics of other people we've read. But he believes that this is true both ethically and in the legal moral sense, as well as it is in the sense of observing what people actually do, our actual behaviors, our actual physical nature. And what this means is that the role of the law is, or the lawmaker, is analogous to the role of the medical doctor. The medical doctor looks at a body, sees a disease, and develops a solution, a treatment for the disease, which will either cure it or at least alleviate it, and that is what the lawmaker, that is what the philosopher, that is what the scholar of politics and ethics is supposed to be doing, is engaging in this kind of process, and so what this means is anything that is ideal, anything that is merely conceptual, is fiction. It's not real. It's pretend. And now there are some things that we can only express in terms of fiction, but even those fictions have to be founded in observable, visible, tangible reality. I have a whole list of things that he gets peeved off about. He doesn't like the concept of moral sense or common sense, the ideas like the law of reason or natural justice or natural law or natural rights. Because frankly, to him, these don't really exist. They're not observable and they're not founded in observable truth. They're founded instead in tradition, in fairy tales, basically. For our friend Bentham, if we want to understand the origins of human action, we need to observe what really causes humans to do what they do. And ultimately, this leads him to the first of the principles we're going to talk about with him, what we could generically call the pain and pleasure principle, or the pain slash pleasure principle, however you want to do it. So in 1780 work entitled Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation, he gives us this long quote. I'm going to read the whole darn thing because it just is great. So nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. It is for them alone to point out what we ought to do, as well as to determine what we shall do. On the one hand, the standard of right and wrong. On the other, the chain of causes and effects are fastened to their throne. They govern us in all of what we do, in all we say, in all we think. Every effort we can make to throw off our subjugation will serve but to demonstrate and confirm it. In words, a man may pretend to abjure their empire, but in reality he will remain subject to it all the while. The principle of utility recognizes this subjection and assumes it for the foundation of the system, the object of which rear the fabric of felicity by hand of reason and of law. Okay, what the heck does this mean? Well, it means a bunch of stuff. But ultimately what it means is that human beings, everything we do and everything we choose not to do is determined by the fact that we are motivated by what a lot of authors would call hedonism, right? That is to say, by the quest for pleasure and the fundamental instinctive urge to pursue pleasure and the fundamental instinctive urge to avoid pain. Now, this has at its root, in essence, two different subdivisions that Mr. Bentham alludes to right here. One is that hedonism can be psychological. It is the grounds of our motives, and insofar as it is that, it is psychological hedonism. But ultimately, if we believe that all our moral decisions and actions as human beings, all sound political policies should be grounded in empirical truth, and psychological hedonism is empirical truth, then we must assume that there is an ethical hedonism, that in fact, like the Greeks who talked about the eudaimonia urge in political philosophy, that the most important focus of our actual policies lay in hedonism, or more accurately, lay in making sure that people experience pleasure and avoid pain. This leads us to what Bentham calls his fundamental axiom. It is the greatest happiness of the greatest number that is the measure of right and wrong. And it is the obligation of leaders and of states, therefore, of course, to adopt policies which lead to that condition. So the measure of goodness, the measure of morality, the measure of ethics, The measure of the quality of any policy is the degree to which it maximizes happiness for the maximum number of people. We can regard this type of philosophy as consequentialist, and we've talked about that a little bit already in some of these earlier lectures. But in the essence, what that means is they hinge upon the moral quality of a political decision hinges upon the consequences of that decision. So we can go all the way back to Machiavelli and see the roots of consequentialism in modern Western thought in that Florentine gentleman's work. Now, to say that Machiavelli would disagree on the standard of what consequences are most important with Mr. Bentham is to say the very least. But to say that both are consequentialist is quite accurate. Now, this leads us to a number of other things. For instance, Mr. Bentham develops what is generally called by political scholars, he doesn't ever use this term himself, but the philosophic calculus. That is to say, how do we calculate the quality of a policy or an action? And remember that our friend Bentham is an empiricist. So he is inclined to believe that any kind of truth in the world that is really valid can be calculated as a quantitative value. And so what do we have to plug in into our calculus to determine its actual scientific degree of morality, according to Bentham? Well, we need to think about, what is the intensity of the happiness to be derived? What is the duration of the happiness to be derived? How certain are we to derive this happiness? In other words, by pursuing the policy, how certain is it that the believed happiness will actually be brought about? How immediate is the happiness? In other words, is the happiness a delayed happiness, which has got all sorts of complications for our species, as I'm sure you know? Or is it a happiness that can be rendered almost immediately? We should also think about, and we think about these both as positives and negatives. We need to calculate anything that adds to or takes away from any of these. And if you think about it, this is in essence a form of rational choice. It's a highly specific, highly hedonistic, in the literal sense of the word, concept of a rational choice, but nonetheless, there it is. Well, he gives us some other principles and concepts that go with this, but so far what we see here is in essence an idea called utilitarianism. What utility is in essence the measure of the quality of a good. A good, a policy, an action, a choice, has value insofar as it has utility, which for Bentham is ultimately happiness. Maximizing happiness for the maximum number of people. Now, he has all sorts of other kinds of insights into happiness that he adds. So, for instance, he has this one concept called diminishing marginal utility. And I'm not sure he actually uses that specific term, but he certainly talks about the concept and his work. So basically the idea is that once we have everything we need, once we are fundamentally satisfied in our physical and social needs, we reach a condition of happiness which is only marginally improved by adding more honor, wealth, power, etc. And we actually know this is kind of scientifically demonstrable. For instance, there's a certain income level, I can't remember the exact number, that if you reach it, it seems that up to that point, every increment of, say, $1,000 to your salary per year is a pretty meaningful increase in quality of life. But after that, increases in salary are only marginally increasing your quality of life. They're adding all sorts of stuff that you don't essentially need to make yourself better. And in fact, you start to become concerned more with the concept of acquiring and maintaining honor, wealth, and power than you are with maintaining security, which and stability, and of course those merely as they contribute to happiness, to having a happy, meaningful life. And that's, I find, a very interesting idea. So there's diminishing or marginal utility. As we increase, as once we've reached a level where we have enough, every additional increment is of questionable utility. Now, this is important because it means that for Bentham, when we conceive of the best policies, then we're going to be disinclined from thinking that it's necessarily a good thing to have, for instance, extremes in wealth. Extremes in wealth mean that you have a lot of people who don't have enough. You have some people who have just the right amount. It sounds like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, doesn't it? And then you have very few people who have way more than they need. And all that stuff that they need that's more than is what is, quote unquote, needed to be happy is only marginally improving the quality of their life. And might possibly be better used in some other way to maximize happiness for more people. So clearly this is an idea that's going to appeal to, again, progressive liberalism. Okay, moving on. We have another concept that's kind of interesting, the disappointment prevention principle. And what it ultimately means is the security of legitimate expectations should take precedence over other ends. In other words, once we've come up with a list of what kinds of policies are necessary to guarantee essential human security, which guarantees essential human happiness, then those have to be our priority if we're going to be ethical over other goal sets. So the disappointment prevention principle. Security of existing happiness is more important than risking it for exceptional happiness for other people. But this is true in a lot of other ways too, right? I mean, ultimately it does have its roots in the kind of security focus of guys like Machiavelli and Hobbes. All right. Let's see. We've talked about the greatest happiness principle. The greatest happiness principle, though, it should be said, does have an important limitation for Mr. Bentham. He saw the potential for minority exploitation and argued that we have to minimize the relative size of what we think of as a minority in every instance in order to conceive of the best policy. In other words, we need to conceive of kind of a universal interest, which is arguably less than perfect. And by maximizing this universal interest, which again, this kind of sounds Rousseauian to me, then we can minimize the number of people who the pursuit of the universal happiness actually discomforts, actually removes happiness from. Again, this can be problematic, as you might imagine. The pursuit of universal happiness might say, well, we sacrifice a little bit of wealth, of the extreme wealth, to make sure that the very poor have what they need to be essentially secure. Or it could mean, well, we take all the people of ethno-national or religious or social minority group and we force them to leave because the bigoted people who make up the majority would be happier with them gone. So that's obviously pretty disconcerting. So we have to be very careful about this utility principle and the greatest happiness concept and all that good stuff. It's problematic when guaranteeing the interests of minorities. And we'll see that J.S. Mill makes a real effort to try and deal with this in his work. So then Mr. Bentham tells us, we go to Bentham and we read him and he gives us an argument for democracy. Now, this is interesting. Remember, Bentham is living in a Britain that is far from what we would consider democratic by modern standards. There's substantial problems with modern or with the democracy at that point. Women completely absent from democracy. If you don't have adequate personal property, you can't participate in the democracy. So it's a minimalistic democratic institutions at best. Plus, we have all sorts of the House of Lords still is a legal body of significance, and we have a hereditary monarch that has real executive power. All of these, to say the very least, undermine representative democracy in the United Kingdom. Bentham says this is a problem. And he says, since those who govern have the same motivations as everyone else, they must work in institutions that ensure that they can only pursue their personal interest by pursuing the public interest or that universal interest we just talked about. To put it a little differently, Bentham is arguing that of course political leaders are just humans and they are still governed by the pain pleasure phenomenon. And of course they're going to pursue pleasure and try to avoid pain. And like other human beings, there is a tendency for them to pursue their own personal interest at the expense of others. But that's unethical. Only the universal interest, the universal good, the greatest happiness is ethical as a political pursuit as opposed to a private personal pursuit. So if we're going to give the political power of the state to individuals, real human beings, then by gosh, we have to take the effort to make sure that their motivations are somehow manipulated into being the same as everyone else. Well, only one institution can do that, democratic republicanism. It takes the interests of the people and it makes them the same as the leader, because if the leader doesn't fulfill the people's interests, then the leader doesn't retain power. In other words, they experience the pain of losing office because they denied pleasure to the people who elected them. That's the idea. So what he wanted, and these sound like such obvious things to us in the modern democratic republican world, but what he wants and argues for are certain reforms, like specific responsibilities to be adhered and defined in law for every job in the bureaucracy, and one would assume a legislated official or elected officials. All offices to be in superior subordinate hierarchies, which allow for clear lines of punishment. In other words, if someone is corrupt or lazy or doesn't do their job, it's clear who's responsible for them and who has the right to punish them, that is to say, to use pain to correct their behavior. Now, again, pain doesn't necessarily mean beating them, but it might mean, you know, you lose your job or you don't get a raise or something like that. Complete exposure of officials to prosecution for wrongdoing. So in other words, if people are committing some sort of legal or ethical wrongdoing in office, there should be no protection of them. They should be able to be sued for this wrongdoing. The elimination of party favoritism, or what we would kind of generically call the spoils system, in appointment and honors. So the idea that I can appoint someone not because they're effective at a job, not because they've passed some sort of civil service examination or proven that they have an appropriate education and moral standing, but because they help me get my political position in a system of patronage, or again, a spoils system, that should be removed as well, he says. We need sunshine government. In other words, government can't work and generate policies through secret mechanisms. I just finished lecturing for East Asia about how opaque the Chinese system is. And this causes all sorts of problems. And this is exactly what our friend Mr. Bentham is worried about. That opacity means that no one can be held accountable for when they do something just stupid or fundamentally immoral. And then he thinks that this is all only going to be sustainable if we have freedom of press, freedom of speech, and freedom of association, not just for people who are in elected office or appointed office, but also for people in general. All right, those are the broad strokes of Bentham's model of utility and utilitarianism, but I want to also mention a couple of his other ideas that are that you could think of as that he's hanging his hat on utilitarianism with these, which are also going to be important in later political thought following him. What is the concept of the panopticon? Now, I mentioned that earlier. Literally, panopticon, if you were to translate it, is the ability, it's the place where you can see everything, or everything can be seen. Panoptica. So, literally, his idea was this, that any kind of institution where there are inmates, now he uses inmate to mean everything from prisoner to patients in a hospital to asylums for the mentally insane or so forth, prisons, workhouses, anything where you have people who need constant supervision should be built on a model that he calls the panopticon. Now, literally, this is, in his eye, or his mind, a circular building. And the circular building is built in such a way that, hypothetically, anyone on duty at any point would be able to observe what any of the inmates, again, whether they're prisoners or patients, is doing. And by being able to observe them, they can then encourage those inmates to engage in what we might call self-discipline. Because what Bentham observes is that when people, quote-unquote, misbehave, when we engage in the pursuit of our own pleasure at the expense of others, including and up to causing them pain, this is more likely to be when we believe we're not being observed. So what this means is that our punishments, oftentimes, in any kind of system where it is built on inmates, has to hinge on the threat of severe punishment, which means we have to be crueler than we might otherwise be. As opposed to, if we had a system where no one is sure if they're being watched or not, people are more likely to engage in self-discipline. They will restrain themselves from acting in pursuit of their personal pain-pleasure principle at the expense of other people's, at the expense of the general utility or the general interest. And that self-discipline then makes things generally happier, generally less violent, generally less cruel. And that's ultimately the idea of the panopticon. And it does have a lot to say for it. I never remember being in a classroom where the students who are sitting right under the noses of the teacher are the ones who are getting in trouble all the time, who are bullying. It's the kids in the back who are more likely to be getting in trouble. And I think we all know that. There is some truth to this. And certainly democracy and republics and modern liberal states, they rely on the concept of self-discipline. If people don't maintain and manage their own behavior, I'm not going to lie, things fall apart. Because governments cannot function as both free and oppressively authoritarian. It just doesn't work. The only way you could be both free and safe is that if almost everyone in society has a fairly high level of self-discipline. So there's some truth to it. The problem is it encourages the surveillance state, right? The vision of a political system in which individuals have to engage in every activity without a sense of privacy. They have to assume those activities are being observed. And therefore, this increases everything from anxiety to distrust of the state, but it also basically, arguably, deprives us of a fundamental human good, privacy. It's a problem in the modern world in particular, since we have so much electronic surveillance. So that's, I think, a very intriguing kind of subject. And it's something that gets talked about quite a bit in modern political philosophy, especially once we get to postmodernism. You know what? I think that's all I'm going to cover for Bentham. I think that's pretty good. We could talk about so much more. It is worth noting that if you have a moment, look up Jeremy Bentham's corpse, because Jeremy Bentham was so dedicated to the general utility that he had himself basically mummified and made into a corpse for the University College London, and like literally his body is still there today. You can go see his body. His head is in his torso. That's a long story, but Google it. It's not gross. It's weird, but it's not gross. Okay. Who does that lead us to? Well, one of Bentham's best friends was a guy named James Mill. James Mill is also one of the great utilitarian thinkers, but frankly, a lot of what he does is he builds on Bentham in thought, and it's going to be really important in particular, in my opinion, because he inspires his son, J.S. Mill. Now, a timeline of J.S. Mill could take a podcast in and of itself, because the guy had a pretty amazing life. He was born in 1806, died in 1873. He was in love with a woman who was married for 21 years before her husband finally died, and then he could marry her. He even tried to dedicate a book to her, and her husband was like, I don't think that's cool, dude. I don't know all the details of that, but I understand that. Among his works, he wrote in 1848, Principles of Political Economy, which is a giant. He wrote in 1859, Considerations on Representative Government. And and the same year he wrote On Liberty. In 1861, he wrote Utilitarianism. And in 1869, he wrote a work called The Subjection of Women. And then his very famous autobiography in 1873. He married his wife, Harriet Taylor, what year did he marry her? I'm not 100% certain. She dies in 1858, but he regards Harriet Taylor the rest of his life as like his partner. There's a lot of question about just how much influence Harriet Taylor had on his ideas, to what degree Harriet Taylor should be regarded as a co-author, in fact, of some of the work of Mill. So just bear that in mind, that every time I talk about Mill and say Mill said, there's this big question mark hanging over it of how much was Mill and how much was Harriet Taylor. I'm not sure exactly. I haven't actually read his autobiography. It may be that the answer is right there in front of us in that very famous book. But goodness. But the other things we need to know is he knows everybody. You know, his dad is James Mill, one of the great political thinkers and activists of his time. One of his dad's best friends is Jeremy Bentham. In fact, Bentham and they would vacation together, and Mill talks about how sometimes there's his dad and there's Bentham, and they would drill him on all sorts of different educational matters. He was fluent in a number of different languages. He was studying Latin and advanced mathematics before he was 9 years old. He was reading the great works of Renaissance Europe not long after that. I'm not even sure exactly how many languages he spoke, but it was many. He would go to college at the University College London, and he was just friends with so many different people. And his dad and Bentham saw him as the future of utilitarianism, that he was literally bred and educated to take on their job, their responsibility when they no longer could do it. He was meant to be the perfect kind of 19th century gentleman crusader for justice, with a background in literature and economics and philosophy and politics and everything you can imagine. And as you might imagine, he kind of had a breakdown. He kind of just fell apart. He lost faith in himself and just kind of unraveled. And he talks about that very frankly in his autobiography and at other points. And he was kind of in this crisis or mental breakdown for almost 4 years, from 1826 to 1830. And he regarded himself as kind of rescued from this crisis by friends of his who weren't from the world of the utilitarians. They were, some of them, political conservatives in the ilk of like Burke, and some of them were romantics, literally poets and literary thinkers. And he will immerse himself in the literatures of both romanticism and conservatism and their traditions because of this. So in many ways, I think it is fair to say that Mill is a syncretist. He's taking utilitarianism, and he's taking romanticism, and he's taking conservatism, and he's weighing them against each other. He's trying to create a more robust, perfect version of utilitarianism. Now, he remains a utilitarian. He doesn't become a conservative. But some of his writing, if you read it, you're like, oh my gosh. And you could see the beginnings of a lot of what is the foundation of modern libertarianism. Other stuff you read and you're like, oh my gosh, and you see the foundation of what is modern democratic socialism. And indeed, he's going to be very important in his influence on those. And he regarded himself in certain letters as, when he was kind of asked to identify himself, he identified himself as a socialist and in that specific context. So he's a very intriguing person. A lot of people think that he is on the verge of self-contradictory. When you read, like, if you're like me, and the first books you read by him are going to be two of his briefest. It's going to be Utilitarianism, and it's going to be On Liberty. They're both wonderful books. They're wonderful. They're very short. They're easy reads. They're both like, you know, find yourself a comfortable chair and it's raining outside and you can get through either one of them easily in a long afternoon. And they're very easy to comprehend and to understand, which is, again, not to be understated, as I'm sure you're realizing at this point, studying political philosophy and theory. So here's the thing. The liberty, what we're going to see is there's an apparent contradiction between utilitarian thought and the thought that he presents in libertarian thought, or in On Liberty. And what it's going to be up to us to determine, and up to you to determine, is to what degree that is an internal conflict, or can they be balanced? And we'll talk about what his understanding of it was, why he didn't think they were necessarily in contradiction. But, you know, let's leave that and get into things. So, our friend Mill agrees with Bentham on the axiomatic nature of psychological hedonism. He's down with psychological hedonism. But he critiques Mill's, or Bentham's understanding of psychological hedonism. He doesn't buy the whole cow. He agrees insofar as that happiness is the only thing desirable in and of itself. And he agrees that humans are always obedient to their interests and that these interests are defined by psychological hedonism. But he doesn't think that this is necessarily something that is crude selfishness. That for instance, sympathy influences this. So part of our hedonist, our pursuit of pleasure and our avoidance of pain is wrapped up in our nature as emotional, empathetic, sympathetic beings. Who's this sound like? Adam Smith. Well, guess what? I don't think he knew Smith personally, but he knew a lot of the guys who were deeply influenced by Smith. Guys like Ricardo and the other kind of early thinkers. He also, by the way, knows guys like Thomas Malthus and all sorts of Robert Thomas Malthus. All these amazing, brilliant thinkers in economics. He knows everybody. But I'll tell you what, he may not have known Smith, but I'm damn certain he read the Theory of Moral Sentiments. And because this is precisely what Smith is telling us, that sympathy and empathy are critical in causing us to evaluate the quality of morality. But for our friend Mr. Mill, he links this to the utilitarian principle. He says that the fact that we feel sympathy, we feel empathy, we can empathize and sympathize with other people causes us to conceptualize their pain and their pleasure as part of our pain and pleasure. So we are able to not have a crude, selfish nature and egoism in our hedonism, which is fascinating to me. Where it's a non-egoistic hedonism, or at best a semi-egoistic hedonism. I don't know, but it's fascinating. Okay, then J.S. Mill also gives us what he calls the proportionality doctrine. I'm going to read a whole text of it, a whole quote from it. All right. So the creed which accepts the foundation of morals, utility, or the greatest happiness principle, holds that actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness. By happiness is intended pleasure and the absence of pain. By unhappiness, pain and the privation of pleasure. Okay, this sounds familiar. And so we can begin to judge pain and pleasure in relativistic forms, in a more subtle way, perhaps, than Bentham does it. Though this does fit into his felicitatious calculus, which again, Bentham never said, but we use to describe his calculus. Where it gets a little bit more complicated is Mill is not just a guy who's an economist who is thinking in simple mathematic terms, but he regards the quality of happiness, or we can measure happiness in two fundamental different ways. One is quantity. So this is going to sound like Bentham. The intensity, the durability, the duration. And the other is the quality or the kind of happiness. And in other words, what Mill is saying is some pleasures are higher than other pleasures. And we can understand this by basically becoming competent judges of those pleasures. This is part of why the liberal arts tradition is critical to utilitarianism, because it teaches us to appreciate the arts, the sciences, the utility of philosophy and mathematics in and of themselves, on and on and on. All these different things, it makes us able to become competent judges of quality. Even if we're not an expert in it, we can begin to recognize that quality and recognize when we're not the competent judge and we need to go and spend time learning about the things so that we can then become a competent judge. And so the competent judge is able to determine what pleasures are greater in quality, not merely quantity. And this means that once we're a competent judge, we can select some pleasures over other pleasures, despite their greater attendant displeasure, because of the quality. The quality is greater and justifies it. Let me give you an example that I would use, for instance, if I'm describing it to one of my friends who's in college. One of the fraternity boys I advise over at my alma mater. So, of course, it's entirely possible to go through life and your whole life you just drink cheap, mass-produced beers. You know, the Bud Lights, the Miller Lights, the PBRs. And there's nothing wrong with that. You can get a lot of them, and they're consistent in quality, and you know exactly what you're getting, and they're cheap. They cost very little in terms of pain or discomfort. And that's fine. Or you can learn to appreciate different kinds of beers. And instead of just getting drunk from beer and drinking to get drunk, which is a kind of pleasure and it has a high intensity, but it also comes with all sorts of obvious problems in the short and long term, you can just have a few more expensive but far more complex, interesting, high-quality beers. In other words, you can acquire a knowledge and an experience of the thing that renders you a competent judge. And so instead of going for low pleasures, you engage with it as a higher pleasure. And this is better in terms of happiness and health for you. And equally, as political leaders, we are obliged to pursue higher pleasures, or at least take higher pleasures into account when we design our political and social and economic systems. It's important to generate competent judges so that people are willing to accept that sometimes there is delayed gratification for higher goods in life. That things that are wonderful sometimes have costs involved. This sounds very different from Mr. Bentham. And it is a mark of the fact that, in my opinion, that Mill has been spending a lot of time with poets and philosophers of aesthetics. He's been hanging out with people who paint and draw pictures and write words for pleasure, rather than people who are thinking simply in terms of socioeconomic and political philosophy and institutions. And it's given him a rounded, more overall complex, subtle understanding of the pleasure principle and the concept of utility. For better or worse, it depends. You may just flat out reject that, and that's totally your prerogative, and I can understand that. Well, okay, fair enough. He also then reacts to Bentham's concept of utilitarianism and some of the criticisms of utilitarianism by writing this short work on liberty. And in On Liberty, he attempts to understand why liberty matters. Why is liberty something we should treasure, that we should defend, that we should reinforce and protect, and try to enshrine in our political institutions? And remember, he is thinking individually, but he's also thinking in terms of collectivities. So, On Liberty, here's a quote from Ed. "The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm from others. His own good is not sufficient warrant. The only part of the conduct of anyone for which he is amenable to society is that which concerns others. And the part which merely concerns himself, his independence, is of right absolute. Over himself, over his own body and mind, the individual is sovereign." Man, that sounds a lot like what we would think of today as a libertarian philosophy, right? It certainly is libertarian to a substantial degree. Now, what this is saying, in essence, is that, well, we can break it down into a couple sub-statements. One is that paternalistic exercises of power are illegitimate. Now, when I say paternalistic, what I mean is if one person is restricting another person's liberty for that person's liberty, A is restricting B's liberty for the benefit of B. So if I say, you can't smoke because smoking is bad for you, that is paternalistic. It is a parent taking care of a child. And that's not acceptable. Why? Well, it's not acceptable for the same reason that paternalism is never a justification in the liberal tradition for rulership. We do not need a parent once we are competent adults. Our parents exist to keep us alive and educate us until we are competent people, at which point we receive individual independence. And therefore, if someone is trying to restrain us because they're afraid we will hurt ourselves, then that is illegitimate. That is paternalism. The most we can do is warn people, but we can't restrain them from engaging in that. So, there's also moralistic restraints, and Mill regards these as illegitimate. So A is restricting B's liberty to ensure that B is ethical or acts morally. So I restrict someone else's liberty in order to prevent them from doing something that I, or even society as a whole, believes is immoral. I'm not going to let you drink because drinking is immoral and leads to immoral activities and choices. That is regarded by Mill as illegitimate. Why? Well, because morality, except insofar as it obeys the pain-pleasure principle, is not empirically verifiable. Rather, it's an ideal. It's cultural or it's personal, and therefore it's not up to society to force us to obey any given moral standard. Okay? Then we have the harm principle. The harm principle is the third different kind of principle that comes from this. And what that is the idea that A can restrict B's liberty if this is done in order to prevent someone other than B from being hurt by B's action. In other words, I can restrain, as the state, someone's liberty legitimately or ethically if that prevents that person through their actions from causing injury to someone else. There you go. So to go back to our smoking example, it is illegitimate for me to say you cannot smoke at all because your smoking will injure yourself. But using the harm principle, I might be able to argue that it is acceptable for me to say there are places you can and cannot smoke. In your home, absolutely. When you're away from other people, unquestionably. But if you're somewhere where other people are going to be near you and can't readily move away and you're going to smoke, well, that's not legitimate because smoking does cause harm. And you are harming people without their consent. And that is immoral. So that is the only justification, the only kind of justification for a limit on liberty. Makes sense, right? Now, what we have to understand that makes this possible is we must distinguish between genuine harm and mere offense. Those are the terms Mill uses, genuine harm and mere offense. So harm is literally the harming of someone, the literal injury of someone. I do not have a right to hurt someone, to cause injury to someone. I tend to think of this in Lockean terms, so life, liberty, health, property. I don't have a right to hurt them in that way. Even if it's in the exercise of otherwise freely of my life, my liberty, my health, or my property. Now, what I can say, however, is that's quite different. I may not have a right to harm anyone, but I have a right to offend someone, to say and do things which they don't believe in, or they think are crude, or rude, or silly, or stupid, or superstitious, or just wrong-headed. Or untactful or vulgar. I have a right to believe in a religion that you don't believe in, or not believe in any religion at all. I have a right to say things that are rude or unkind or uncouth as long as my actions do not cause real harm. And that is the critical determining factor that will help us to understand the harm principle in practice. I can restrain you if you are harming someone. I cannot restrain you if you are merely offending someone. Now, that line obviously is a line that's constantly debated even today. I mean, talk about things like video game restrictions and movie ratings and what can people wear in public, you know? These are all important questions. Like the whole nudist argument is essentially linked to this. So you can really dive deep into this, and it's quite interesting. So there are some clarifications we have to make sure we're on the same page with Mill here. One is this means that there is a clear and definitive essential need of a defense of expression. And this is broad. This includes both expression of speech, it includes association, it includes expression of vocation, you name it, right? So one of the things is we have to bear in mind that censored opinions and lifestyles and so forth, they actually may be true. Just because we believe something is wrong ourselves, or even our society believes something wrong is wrong or untrue, doesn't mean that it's untrue. Secondly, if something is false, it still may contain some utility, some truth that may tend to be valuable eventually. Three, if something is wholly false, then at least having it around is presenting an alternative to the truth, which forces us to constantly reconsider the truth, constantly reevaluate the truth, constantly test it again, constantly prove its validity, which prevents the truth from becoming mere dogma. In other words, something we believe without having justified it through any kind of empirical or philosophical act. Because dogma is truth that has lost its meaning, if it is true dogma. So ultimately, this freedom of expression creates diversity. And diversity causes us to onwardly continue the development of truth, the progression of truth. It reinforces and stabilizes and makes healthier the truths we already have, and it helps to reveal truths that we don't have yet. And so this is a critical thing. What this implies is that a society is generally improved by diversity. Diversity of opinion, diversity of belief, diversity of faith, all of these things are useful rather than detrimental. As long as we respect each other's liberty within the construct of that diversity. He also makes it clear that when he talks about liberty, he's really focusing on basic liberties. Liberty of conscience, of expression, liberty of taste, liberty of pursuits, life choices, things like occupation, things like partners, and liberty of association. Those are really, really clearly his main focus. What I would call like First Amendment liberties in the United States. So if we want to clarify the key elements of the harm principle, to wrap it up, we could say, harm is not the same as mere offense. The harm principle is to be applied whenever harm is inevitable or reasonably risky. So this is critical. Harm doesn't have to be 100% likely for the harm principle as a basis for legitimization of limiting liberty to be applied. But there needs to be a reasonable, acceptable risk implied. The risk of harm from allowing someone to exercise their liberty, if it's sufficient, is enough to limit their liberty. It is wide-scoped. This is really important, I think. The harm principle should be applied, of course, to governments. Governments should not be able to limit our behavior unless that behavior is causing harm. And that's a very good standard for governments. The limitation of government. But equally, we need to apply it in our private relations. Husband to father and children, for instance, right? Does a husband have a right, or a wife have a right, to harm their significant other? And the answer, according to Mill, is no. You have no right. Engaging in a private relationship is no justification for harming someone. Your liberty is not protected insofar as harming another person, whether it is through the mechanism of the state or it is through private, social, or economic relations. And this is a really critical thing. Finally, it's important to bear in mind when we're talking about the harm principle that we're talking about non-consensual harm. There is a difference between harming someone in a boxing match or a wrestling match or a karate match or a judo match or a taekwondo match. Or maybe those guys who dress up like medieval knights and beat the tar out of each other. If you accidentally break someone's nose in any of those scenarios, then the participants have all entered into it of their own free accord, well, that's not a violation of the harm principle. People have a right to put themselves in harm's way, knowing the risks. To play football, I know you can get hurt. To play baseball, I know the ball might hit you in the head or chest, which is what happened to me once, flipped me. It was horrible. But in the end, consensual harm is really critical. And as you can imagine, in the era of the present day, where we're also talking about things like all sorts of intriguing kind of social and sexual choices, consensualism is critical to the harm principle as well. Non-consensual harm is never acceptable under any condition. Consensual harm, that is to say, where we agree on something which may be deemed harm from an external perspective, or may involve the risk of harm from an external perspective, is a very different, more complicated thing. So that leads us to this question: are utility and liberty in conflict? Ultimately, for Mill, from what we read, especially from the Principles of Political Economy, which he writes before On Liberty and Utilitarianism, it seems like he certainly doesn't regard them as being in conflict. See, for Mill, liberty is critical, as is utilitarianism. Yes, there are tensions there. There are complications that are rooted in things. But ultimately, what we have to bear in mind is that Mill is practical. He's trying to make things work. And so the ultimate appeal has to be to utilitarianism. So liberty is ultimately functioning as an element in the utilitarian calculus. Well, that's the interpretation that I would give. I really hang my hat on the editor's introduction by Stephen Nathanson to John Stuart Mill's Principles of Political Economy. He does a wonderful job explaining it. And I'm inclined to agree with his interpretation. That said, you don't have to agree. It's entirely reasonable to say Mill wrote Principles of Political Economy. Let's see, what year did he write that? He wrote that all the way back in 1848. He writes Utilitarianism in 1861 and On Liberty in 1859. A man's life can change. A man's perspective can change quite a bit in that period of time. So it's entirely conceivable that, in fact, he didn't see them as easily resolvable, but he did see them as important in tension and just didn't try to resolve that tension. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with accepting that contradictory concepts that are rational and exist in tension with each other are both things that we should take into account. Fair enough. Guys, this has been the lecture on utilitarianism, focusing on Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. And I hope you're all doing well. I hope you're safe and sound and healthy. And I will talk to you soon. Have a lovely day. And take care of yourself.